Welcome to this episode of the Genetically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Eli Robertson, and today I'll be talking to Katrina Klopp. Katrina, would you introduce yourself for our audience?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Eli. My name is Katrina Duong. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. And if it's okay, I'd like to introduce myself in my indigenous language.
Absolutely.
Great. Tohana Nesha, Dashini Bashashin, Tordichini Dashache, Badani Dashanella, Dak Elena Dant Nasha, Diet A Dinestan Nesha. Thank you. I just introduced my clans and where I'm from on the Navajo Nation.
Thank you for that. And thanks for being with us today. Could you start us off by walking us through your career so far and how you've ended up where you're at now?
Yeah, sure. I've been an assistant professor here at CU Anschutz for about 4 years, a little over 4 years. Before that, I was a postdoc and a PhD student at the University of Washington, focusing on genomics and pharmacogenomics, which is what I do in my lab now. So a lot of my research is related to identifying pharmacogenomic genetic variation in many underrepresented populations, including American Indians and Alaska Native populations. As a part of my work with Native communities, a lot of it is based on community-based research. So a lot of my projects are in partnership with tribal communities. And as those partnerships have developed and evolved, it became clear that some communities weren't quite ready to begin genomics research projects, but were more interested in thinking about the implications of genomic research, which is the other aspect of my research program and where I look at the cultural, ethical, legal, and social issues related to genomic research in many underrepresented communities. So my lab sort of does both of these things, and it's very diverse, but we study primarily the cytochrome P450 enzymes in relation to drug metabolism. So that's where I am now, but I grew up in Arizona and in my tribal community in northeastern Arizona, and then went to Arizona State for my undergraduate, and then the rest is history. I'm so excited to be here and starting this research program here at University of Colorado.
Well, everyone's got sort of ups and downs in their career. And one of the hard things about doing research is that oftentimes you don't even know if you're going to like what you're working on until you've jumped in and you started doing it. And then it's sometimes too late and you end up having to change course. Are there any decisions along the way that if you had a chance, you might go back and change? Or are there any events through your career that you're really grateful for because it's helped you out as you've been starting your career?
I guess in thinking back, I honestly don't have any regrets. I'm of the mindset that everything happens for a reason, whether it's difficult situations. They also teach you a hard lesson that is good for the future. If you learn a hard lesson, you're likely not to repeat that in the future. But also, there have been a lot of good decisions that I've made without knowing that they were going to be so good for me. I guess one thing that I sort of wish that I had a lot more experience in it, as I start to mentor students, I wish I had done a little bit more intentional training on how to be a good mentor. But I've been able to sort of catch up on this as there are some resources here, a junior faculty mentoring program that really get into how to mentor students. But I think that also in mentoring, one of the best ways is just to experience it yourself and work with students, try to be transparent. So that's the only thing that I've regretted a little bit. Otherwise, I'm pretty happy with where I am. And I think it's also because I took a longer time during my postdoc just to make sure that I was making the right decision. My postdoc was for 5 years, and I was lucky to have funding throughout that 5 years that allowed me to stay that long, but it's not typical to stay that long as a postdoc, but I feel like it really prepared me for running my own research lab and prepared me for a lot of things that come up.
A theme running through this season is interviewing successful scientists that also have an interest in promoting increased diversity and equity and inclusivity of the scientific workforce and in scientific studies. What do those principles mean to you?
Those principles are very important to me and to many others. When I think about diversity, equity, and inclusion, I really think about what makes me comfortable and what makes me want to bring my whole self to my workplace. And I think my whole self is not just the research side. It's also the community and the culture that I'm coming from. It also includes my family, so my son and my extended family. It includes different perspectives and it includes my community. So when I think of DEI initiatives, that's what I think about. And it's everywhere, not just in my work, but also in my research. In my work, I partner with a lot of tribal communities, and many of my research collaborators are Indigenous and from those communities. I think my lab is pretty diverse in both Indigenous and non-Indigenous students. Even the environment that I have here in the lab, I try to promote that diversity and those values in the wall hangings, in the onboarding process, and everything, just making sure that people know that they can come to me and that they're welcome and they can bring their whole self. So I think that that's sort of what I think of when I think about those principles.
I think that you've noted that there are communities that are maybe underrepresented in research studies and in the benefits of genomics, but that there's also sometimes a disconnect between the genomics community and the cultures of the Diné or other Indigenous peoples. So how did you start to implement community engagement as part of your research process?
It was very intentional. As a graduate student, I did not do any community-engaged research. I did not work with Native communities, mostly because I felt like I wasn't at that stage yet. I hadn't received any training. And even though I could work with my own community and was a member, I felt like I needed that additional training. So during my postdoc, I intentionally decided to work with a group called the Northwest Alaska Pharmacogenomics Research Network, which we're doing pharmacogenomics research in partnership with Native communities, but also at their core of their research was this community-based participatory research approach. So they already had spent years forming partnerships with these different tribal communities, and I came in as a postdoc just to learn how they formed those connections, to make those connections myself with communities. And I spent a long time just making those connections and seeing how it's done on the ground rather than just reading about it. And I also took many classes in CBPR methods, some from really well-known people like Dr. Bonnie Duran. Part of my postdoc was also with a very well-known bioethicist, Dr. Wiley Burke. So she was my co-mentor, and I really received a lot of training from her, did directed readings. So it wasn't until I felt like I was ready to and had enough training that I actually started working with communities. And some of those partnerships that I started as a postdoc are people I'm working with now doing research. So it's really a long process, but also for me, it happened a little bit naturally and also on a timeline that was a little more conducive to forming those partnerships.
Do you have recommendations for other scientists that are interested in doing genomics work that might include traditionally underrepresented communities on how to approach it and figure out what works best for the people and the scientists? Because you want to approach this in a culturally sensitive way, and it's more than just getting someone to agree to give a DNA sample.
Yeah, definitely. This was one of our publications with the Sing Consortium a couple of years ago. We created this framework for interacting with Indigenous communities on this very topic. So we go through, and it's very short because of word limits, but we could have gone on and on. It sort of outlines something that is very well known in other fields in public health and social work, different frameworks for working with communities. So we took a lot of those existing frameworks and applied it to genomic research. So I think that that paper is still a great resource, but there are other new and upcoming research that have been published by various groups around the United States. And also more broadly, there are many groups internationally who have created guidelines for genomic biobanking, for conducting genomic research. So a lot of this research is out there and readily accessible to anyone who's interested in engaging communities and research.
Changing things up a little bit, can you tell us about the Summer Internship for Indigenous Peoples in Genomics Consortium and what kind of work that you do with them?
Yeah, so I've been a longtime participant of Sing, as well as more recently a faculty. So this summer internship for Indigenous Peoples in Genomics workshop started in the very first workshop in 2011, and I was a participant then as a graduate student. Since then, it has changed and has changed its focus a little bit. But in the end, I think the goal is to expose both trainees and community members to what genomic research is. We have a wet lab component where people are able to learn how to pipette and sequence DNA and analyze the DNA. But the other aspect is also the thinking about the ethical issues that arise when working with DNA and thinking about it and how it affects Native communities. So it's been really great. And during the pandemic, we did virtual sings, and we just had our last sing in July of this year in Arizona. There was a lot of connection with some of the communities out there, but over the years it has changed. We had different themes for a bit. So when it was hosted in Seattle, we had a pharmacogenomics theme, and then at University of Arizona, it was more cancer-based, and then this year, it was more based on microbes and bacteria. So it does change over time, but it has formed a big network. So Sing USA was the first Sing that was established, and after a couple years later, Sing Aotearoa was established in New Zealand by Maori individuals interested in creating a similar program, but in the Maori cultural context. And so they have hosted many Sings over the past couple years. More recently, there was a Sing Australia with many Indigenous Australians attending. I know there's going to be Sing Chile, Sing Mexico. There's a really well-established program in Canada, Sing Canada. It has a lot of the values and foundation of what Sing originally was and is familiar to many Indigenous communities, some of the same issues. I think that's why other places have wanted to start their own Sings, and it's really become an international community at this point.
And the opportunities don't just stop at trainees and community members. There's also mentoring and precision medicine for faculty members. So what's the PRIME faculty mentoring program?
Oh, great. I'm glad you brought that up. The PRIME program, PRIME stands for Precision Health and Genomics, Indigenous Mentoring and Ethics Programs. I was able to get a diversity, equity, and inclusion supplement grant funded last year. And initially, it was really to fund two of my students who are from underrepresented backgrounds in the lab, a postdoc and a graduate student. But then there were other opportunities that arose. So the PRIME program kind of became this mentoring platform where we have the PRIME faculty program, which engages. Right now, we have 6 Indigenous faculty who are a part of the program, who are all from around the United States. And that aspect is really focused on providing the necessary mentoring and other writing strategy tools and things that folks need to, or things that I wish I had when I came into my faculty position, and really providing a peer mentoring community for faculty. This culminated this summer in a PRIME writing retreat. We hosted a week-long writing retreat really focused on generating writing strategies and really focusing on how can people keep productive and remain productive. So that was a really intense week. And then throughout the year, it's a year-long program. So we meet monthly. We have different topics that we talk about. Our recent one was work-life balance and maintaining connections with your community, even as faculty member. Future topics include building a successful research laboratory and program. And then we have a mentoring session on how to mentor any trainees that come into your lab and establish, really just trying to give folks the baseline foundation for having a successful program. And it's a peer mentoring aspect. So I participate as well as the participant. So I learn just as much as they're learning, I'm hoping. And it's really just the way we can foster connections across early career Indigenous faculty throughout the United States. So that's the fun program part. But as a part of that, we've built these different mentoring materials. Some of them include a modified individualized development plan. Another includes just ways of keeping track of your papers and your grants that you're writing, and Others include ways to assess communication styles in your lab and with lab members. So it's been really fun. And some of these materials were things that people in the program brought to our overall group, and we've sort of put them all together as a resource for people. More locally at University of Colorado, the PRIME program also is hosting a series of seminars of Indigenous speakers working at the intersection of precision health and genomics and ethics. So we've hosted two speakers in the last couple months. And when the speakers come, they give a seminar. We also have an informal networking mentoring session for anyone who's interested. And then these folks also meet with our faculty locally and meet with different trainees. So we are excited that our next speaker is coming up and he's going to give our talk, and we're very excited. I'm also a part of this program where I'm hosting two Indigenous students in my lab, and they're doing amazing work and working on different research projects related to pharmacogenomics and ethics.
Well, there's lots of ways to be involved in science. Being a researcher is definitely one of them. But as you had noted, during training, you're mostly taught how to do research and how to be a scientist, but not necessarily how to mentor and do those other things. So the PRIME program seems like it would be really great for teaching people how to do that. For people who aren't there, how could they get involved with something like PRIME? Or do you have any advice for how to start their own peer mentoring program that's similar?
Yeah, I've been thinking on this a little more. I think that at least at my institution, we have different opportunities for mentorship. We have a faculty mentoring program called the JUMP program, and that is really geared towards mentors and how to mentor. So that's been really great locally. There are other programs more nationally. So I'm forgetting the whole name of it, but it's a diversity program where they teach you skills on how to write, really focus on writing, but also organizing yourself and thinking about what your time sucks are, and also intentionally creating these individualized plans to promote your goals. So I think that there are programs out there. I also get a lot out of attending different conferences that have a established program for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Some of those are the SACNAS National Conference. I also frequently attend the ACES National Conference, which is American Indian Society for Engineering and Sciences, and ABRCAMS. I think that all of those, there are quite a few workshops that really focus on how to be a good mentor, how to promote diversity in your research and program. And also, I think that as a new faculty, well, kind of new faculty here, we've also started a new PI group here in our department. So that just gives an opportunity for new PIs to come together once a month. We have lunch and we just discuss some of these topics, like how do you even hire someone? And we discuss budgets and grants. So it's been really good to get that informal peer mentoring from peers within my department. So anyone can do that on their own, wherever they are. And then also there are, now that we have a lot of different technologies that are connecting people on social media, there are quite a few groups that talk about these issues and anyone can become a subscriber to them. There's one that I follow about BIPOC women who are in academia, and I just see so many posts that I connect with. There are also solutions that are often presented there, like how to approach your chair about some issue. I find that social media is nice in that aspect, and that it's able to connect people and you can participate anonymously if you would like. But those are some ideas or suggestions that I think people can look into.
Something that you said before, I think can really resonate across all different kinds of careers, that part of being happy is being able to be your full self. Like part of your work is bringing your full self to work and being able to be who you are. How do you go about balancing all those different parts of your life, and what kind of support systems do you have in place for yourself?
It's always a tough balance, and sometimes certain things take precedent. So last week my son was sick, so obviously I didn't get to do much of the research aspect. I think a part of the balance is just trying not to overload yourself and being able to say no. And I feel like a lot of the best lesson I've learned from being in this field and in academia is learning how to say no. That has helped me a lot. And also, I think I have a really great network of support, both professional mentors and personal mentors. So I have folks who I've known since I was an undergraduate and who have just always been promoters and cheerleaders for me in anything that I do. And then I have some academic mentors who are in my field and in my department or more abroad who really can advise me on how to move forward in different things. And I use them regularly. And I think that has been really helpful. Also, my network of peer mentors has been really great. Sometimes I found that as I've been progressing through this field, there was never really a Indigenous mentor who was in genomics, who was like at more established level, but I was able to find a lot of peers who were at my same level or a little above me who were able to provide a lot of really great mentorship. That has been really great. And then also from the personal mentors, I have my dad who really provided me with that cultural background, and any issues that I come up with, I would always go to him first. And then also I have a really large extended family who are sort of always the cheerleaders, but also are supportive, and with any difficulties that I have, they are always ready to help in any way. So I think that I'm really lucky that I have all of these different support systems, and it doesn't really matter where you go, I think, but in order to succeed, you do have to have those support networks, which I realize as an undergraduate student and as a graduate student and postdoc, that if you don't have those support networks, it's a lot harder to succeed. And what I've learned is that it's never going to be just one person or mentor who is going to make that support network, but you sort of have to create it out of a bunch of different people in order to succeed. But yeah, I think it's been great to have all of these networks.
So you've had a lot of peers in genomics that you've helped to support each other, but over time, you're sort of now going to be turning into the people that you were looking for when you were younger trainees, and you're starting to mentor people who are really just starting their career and younger trainees and people that are looking for their own source of advice. So what sort of advice do you give people who are at earlier career stages now, and how do you make the environments around you more fair and inclusive for them?
This is exactly what I'm doing right now. I have a couple trainees that I'm working with. I always start with, you don't have to know what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And I felt like I always had to know what I was doing for the rest of my life at every stage of my career. But in reality, at those stages, I really didn't know what I was going to do. And when I think back on it, I was lucky that I recognized some paths as I was progressing and chose those paths just because I felt that they were right for me. But even if they make mistakes, I think they're also learning opportunities. So I try to approach it in that way. And each person that I work with is an individual, so they have different backgrounds and different things that are important to them. So I try to think about that first. But some things that have really helped me with mentoring trainees is making sure it's a safe place for them, be that in my office, be that in my research program, or even in the department, making sure that first and foremost is that they're comfortable and safe. And then also really trying to approach the mentoring relationship with a little bit more, I guess, context. So I try to establish responsibilities and expectations, both as a mentor myself and from a mentee, so that there's not any misunderstandings in why we are here, why we're talking. And it does vary based on what their mentoring relationship is. So I think that has been really helpful in making sure that we're on the same page. And then also understanding that maybe I'm not going to be the right person to mentor or support those people. And that's okay. And I think it's okay for me to step back and for them to step back and give each other space and make sure that they find that support. So I'm here to support them. I don't have to be the person doing all of the mentoring. I really try to do that in all of my work with my students, and also thinking about the big picture. So I have everyone usually fill out a sort of a modified version of an individualized development plan, and also think about what's really important to them in the future, not just this PhD, but what do they want to do in the future and what's important for them. Is it their family, and how can we promote having that a part of their life in the futures? So I think that just thinking about that has really helped me when working with trainees.
You know, when people say diversity, equity, and inclusion, it really can touch every aspect of the things that we do, from training to doing science as a career to the actual research projects to being involved in science and choosing whether you want to know some of the information that's found when people do research with your DNA and how it would impact you. So this is an enormous area. And if you had to step back and think about it for a second, is there an aspect of DEI in any of those processes that you are really the most passionate about?
That's a hard one. I think that, I guess in my perspective, as someone who's really interested in increasing Indigenous representation in a lot of genomic studies, just because of the past history, I think one of the most pressing issues that I see is the lack of Indigenous people in higher education, whether that be faculty positions, graduate schools, or as postdocs. I think for me, that is something that I want to increase, and in any way that I can, just because I see how important this issue is. And the only way to really create change, I feel, is to have those folks as a part of the research process. And having been a first-generation student and also now as a faculty member, I have personally experienced and witnessed a lot of those challenges that come with finding your place socially, whether it's like making ends meet financially and also navigating this class structures and racial structures in the academy. I think, of course, that has always been tough. And often with a lot of these initiatives, they're great and all, but often they do tax the people you're trying to promote. I can't tell you how many DEI committees I've been asked to be on. And luckily, I have said no to most of them, but also with trying to establish a research program or even for students trying to balance their coursework. Of course, they're interested in being a part of these initiatives, but sometimes they tax students, they tax underrepresented faculty, and we often overcommit ourselves. And I think that providing support for that process and making sure that everyone is a part of that process and not just the underrepresented people promoting these initiatives, I think that's something that needs to be addressed in at every level. But I'm hoping that some of these initiatives bring more Indigenous and American Indian and Alaska Native folks into the research labs, into running these programs, and really promoting a lot of change in the field.
Well, I think that's great. I would totally agree that that tax is often not fair and that the work has to be spread around, and making an initiative is pretty easy, but in actually enacting the change and spreading that workload is pretty hard, but totally worth it in the end. Thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today.
Right. Thank you so much.
This has been Eli Robertson, and we've been Genetically Speaking. Thanks so much for joining us today. Join us again next week for another episode.